In today's podcast, we'll explain why the Wolves are falling apart, if the Hornets are this year's Pacers, and whether the Celtics actually have a shot in the East. That's coming up right now. All right, joining me to talk about the Minnesota Timberwolves, host of the Dane Moore NBA podcast, Dane Moore. Dane, how are you?
I'm all right, man. You know, I'm ready for the All-Star break too, just like the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah, they definitely seem like they're ready for the All-Star break at this point. They've lost 8 out of 13. They're 12-12 since Christmas. Rudy Gobert had his quote that went very viral recently where he said, you know, basically Chris Finch needs to start benching players who are putting in low effort. He said it's not an easy position for a coach to take guys out of the game. If the players don't have accountability, someone has to have accountability for the players. The effort, to me, for a team that wants to play for a championship is unacceptable. Who is Rudy Gobert talking about, Dan?
Anthony Edwards and Julius Randle. I mean, there's another part of the quote. We had an extensive back and forth, he and I, about this. He had another line about, like, it doesn't matter if you score 50 points. You know, we're not going to win without the effort, and specifically the effort on defense, you know? So that's, I don't know, it's not like ambiguous. It's also very obvious if you've been watching the Timberwolves play this season, especially over the last, you know, 3-4 weeks. Ant and Julius, who take a huge load offensively, are the only players on the team who can really score at a high clip. They have not been defending at a high clip. It wasn't like a crazy call out to me in that sort of way, in that it was untrue in any sort of capacity. It's probably not a good idea as a teammate. I think it's was a weaker moment from Rudy in that maybe that's not a good idea. Finch didn't like him saying that, but if you've been watching them play, if you were their teammate, I think that's a natural feeling to have had about the Timberwolves lately. Just maybe don't say it to me.
Yeah, look, I think Rudy saying it, Chris Finch had his quote as well, basically saying how, you know, anybody who knows how we do things here, there's a high degree of accountability. And secondly, he said, I handle all our conversations with each other in-house. Disappointing that Rudy Gobert felt the need to go outside. Maybe Rudy felt like he had to, though, Dane, because the effort's been so piss poor. I mean, you saw the game, the Wolves loss against Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi goes off, and it's not all Ant's fault. But I thought his effort in the start of that second half, they went at him. First two possessions of that second half, John Collins scored over him. Not a big deal. Then Kawhi Leonard had an amazing shot. Fadeaway jumper. Looked like Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan. Not a big deal. But then the third play in a row, Ant just fell asleep defending Derrick Jones Jr. in the corner. Barely saw the ball come and just followed the ball and reacted late. Derrick Jones Jr. got a quality shot opportunity. And I think that stretch, that sequence, speaks to what Gobert is talking about, and maybe some public accountability is necessary. So I don't have as much of a problem with it.
Yeah, I would distinguish between the first two clips that you showed there of Ant getting scored on in isolation versus the third clip. The issue is not Ant's ability to guard in isolation. Ant's actually good at defending in isolation. What is plummeted Ant's defensive numbers this season, and what just stands out when you're watching the games is the third clip there where you're standing flat-footed. It's all about off-ball defense for him. And I think that is so tied to the energy and effort conversation of specific to Ant, because it's not that he's not playing hard. It's not that he's not putting in effort. He's putting it in selective areas, as all star players who score 30 a game do, but he's selecting the wrong areas to do it. What the Timberwolves need from Anthony Edwards is him to be locked in off ball. That would have the most impact positively on the defense. What the Timberwolves, I don't think, need Ant to do, that happens sometimes, he tries to spark him, right? Like, gets a big bucket, has the dunk, and he's like, all right, I'm picking up full court here. That's not what they need. They don't need that, and that's a bad use of the finite amount of energy that Ant has that he's able to use every night on the defensive side of the floor. They need him. I'm like, you got to bend your knees there, bud. Like, that, you're standing there flat-footed. You got to be locked in. You need to be a low man presence. They do not have Ant guard the point of attack on this team. His job is to guard the guys off ball. It's often he's guarding Derek Jones Jr. or that version of that player in the corner. And all that guy can do to really score on you is to get an open catch and shoot three or punish you on the offensive glass, crashing from the corner. And Ant lets those things happen far too often. Kawhi got him. I don't have a problem with Kawhi. Kawhi got him multiple times in isolation there, as he does to the best defenders in the league. John Collins has got 5 inches on Ant. He took him in the post and scored over him. I don't care about those two, but it's all compounded, and it makes it the whole conversation now. We're expanding it to be something more than it is. The issue with Ant is off-ball defense. That would make the biggest difference for this team if he was more locked in there. And frankly, Kevin, they don't have, like, it's a need. There's not like another route, like Ayo Dosunmu coming in here or having Jaden McDaniels or Rudy Gobert. They need Ant and Julius to be defenders on and off the ball, and they're not doing that right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 100% sure. I think the first two clips there, it happens. Guys are going to score on you. It's just the fact that two plays in a row, they attack you. And then the third play when, oh, wait a minute. I can take a rest this play. No. You can't take a rest on this play just because there's not a guy in front of you with the ball in his hands. You still need to be locked in. I thought it was, like you said, the first two plays, forgivable. The third one is where the big issues are. And that doesn't even, we have barely touched on Julius Randle. There's kind of the semi-viral clip posted the other day, Julius Randle effort tape versus New Orleans. I just thought it was funny. This was posted on X. It was like a minute 15. And some of these clips in here were unfair to Randle. A lot of them were definitely very fair, you know, jogging back on defense and all that. The Julius Randle thing, Dane, it's never going to change. He was like this in college at Kentucky. When I used to write for Celtics blog covering the draft back then, I wrote a whole article about why I have Julius Randle ranked outside the top 10. And it was all about his defense, the lack of effort, the piss poor effort that he put in college. This has been a thing for him over a decade. It's not going to change. And so I think with Randle, he also, we've seen him have moments and stretches where he defends on ball and he shows his versatility moving his feet. But the off-ball awareness and intensity from him, I just have zero expectations that is ever going to change for him. And so if two of your players are playing this way, that is why it is an issue for Minnesota. It's that the effort definitely does matter. All that said, though, Dean, how much of this is just... this team has been to back-to-back Western Conference Finals. They're taking it a little easier right now. How much of this is just mid-season coasting for Minnesota and that it'll feel like a distant memory at some point come April and May?
Yeah, I mean, I still wouldn't want to play the Timberwolves in the playoffs. Like, you know, they've had a terrible couple week stretch, 5-game losing streak, then they beat the Thunder. And then they kind of have these last 5 games, which were flat effort the whole time. This team can absolutely turn it up. Turn up the dial and beat anybody. And to that end, I wouldn't want to play them. But are they the 7th seed today right now? Like, this is barely a playoff team at this point. And it is a product of them coasting largely during the regular season, specifically against teams like the New Orleans Pelicans. I mean, and they talk about it, man. I've asked these guys about, I'm sick of asking them about it. I'm sure they're sick of me asking about this thing. And they say, you know, it's tough when it's a team with a bad record. They might not have a main guy out there to stay focused and have the... And had a good quote to me of it. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. He goes, it's not hard to find the why to play, but it's hard to find the energy to do it when a team, you know, when you're playing a tanking team, a strip mine team in that sort of way. I get that to some extent. The issue is this team does not have the margin for error to be able to do that. They lose those games. They're losing games like this too often, and it's pushing them down to, yeah, the 6th seed in the West, and the teams behind them, you know, Phoenix has beat them a couple times. They play hard all the time. You know, like, it's just no guarantee that the Wolves are going to be one of the top 6 teams when the season comes to the end. And man, I think they need to be a top 3 team to really be able to give themselves a puncher's chance to go somewhere in the playoffs, because if you're playing the first, like if you're the 6th seed, you're playing one of these really tough teams in the first round and then on the road, and then you're playing another one of them in the second round and another one of them in the next round. Like, I don't know. This is not a good conference to be buried in. And they're burying themselves with inconsistent effort. It's very much that clear, coasting, whatever you want to call it.
And that's ultimately why it's so vital for them. I mean, you just see the standings on screen right now if you're watching us on YouTube. The OKC Thunder, San Antonio Spurs, Denver Nuggets, LA Lakers, Houston Rockets, and then the Minnesota Timberwolves a half game up on the Phoenix Suns for the play-in spot in the 7 seed. If you can get that 2 seed and you're facing a scrappy Suns team in round one or an old Warriors team or a stripped-down Clippers team, that's what you want in the first round. Yes. And they're still
need.
Within
it's
reach.
Need. It's a need, Kevin.
It's need.
It's a need.
Yes, exactly. And they're only 5 games back from San Antonio right now. They should be up there a half game back or a half game ahead. But this lack of effort is killing them right now in the standings. And it therefore could be what leads to their demise come playoff time, even ahead of what it was the last 2 years. And that's what's so disappointing to me with Minnesota and why I think this team was involved in Giannis conversations. Tim Conley, the GM, is going to take a swing and at least see what's out there for a guy like that, as a guy who could be a needle mover. And why the Ayo Dosunmu acquisition was important for this team, adding another wing defender, adding another guy who can hit threes off the catch, adding another guy who can do a little bit off the dribble as well. Dosunmu helps this team, but he's not this huge needle mover that's going to be a culture changer for this team. It has to come from the top, but ultimately he does help. I think he's going to help. What did you see from him in his first game with the Wolves?
Well, can I touch on the top piece of it a little bit too? I didn't get to respond to the Julius thing because I think there's some important pieces there. Ayo fills a need that this bench has. There's like a Nickeil Alexander Walker sized hole on the Wolves bench, and there has been all season. And that has had a profound impact on the bench this year. And it's had a profound impact, I think, on the energy and effort. I think Ayo is going to fit that great. I really do. And watching it last night for the first time, I go, there's a diversity of skill set on offense and on defense that he's going to be able to fill in a bunch of little holes. It's not great on either side. He doesn't have one dominant skill set, offensively or defensively, but he is going to more than fill the hole that's on the bench. The problem is, Kevin, that hole on the bench is irrelevant if the issues at the top, as you said, persist as they have the whole season. And I think to some extent, your Anthony Edwards is your 24-year-old superstar player, and you're married to the volatility that comes with some of his individual performance tied to his still growing maturity. The Julius variable is the interesting one to me, and Finch is a Julius Randle stan, and we can talk about some of that. But the issue with Julius, you said that Julius will never do this, is never going to play defense. He's never going to put in the effort. And that's not true. He did do that earlier in the season. And there has been pockets of time where he has been a critical, valuable piece to the Wolves on both sides of the ball. The issue with Julius Randle is intense moodiness. It's intense moodiness. And it's a mental health issue. And he's talked about that. Everybody, you know, the thing that sticks out to everyone about Julius Randle and the mental health is he talked about stopping smoking weed, right? And that's the Julius Randle mental health story. But locally, we've covered this more deeply. And Julius has talked about his issue being with his moodiness and how he would never want to be a coach because he would never want to have to coach somebody like him because he has this self-awareness of his moodiness that is extremely problematic to consistency, is extremely problematic to effort. And earlier in the season, we were lauding his self-awareness of that, addressing his mental health in that sort of way. But the reality of the situation is that has come somewhat loose. And the mental health element of Julius Randle is hurt like Aaron Gordon's hamstring is hurt right now. And did some of that have to do with him, his name being in trades for the last 2 weeks for Giannis Antetokounmpo? I don't know exactly. I would glean that probably that was a factor, and it's been picked up. I'm there in the locker room all the time. Julius Randle has been more moody the last 2 weeks than he was the 2 weeks prior to this, than he was the first 2 months of the season. There is a mental health issue with Julius Randle that he's talked about himself, and that sounds like some sort of attack, but we do this thing where we distinguish the difference between a mental health issue and a physical health issue, and give me Julius Randle's mental health issue that he has found ways to resolve before you give me Aaron Gordon's hamstring issue, which there's nothing he can do about there. So I think it's wrong to say that there's absolutely nothing that Julius Randle can do, has done, and that the effort and has not been there the whole time, because that isn't the case. When Julius is in a clear headspace, he's a hell of a player, and he's been that this season. How bankable is it? I don't know. Frankly, I'm starting to fade on it, but that is a big part of this story right here. And I think it determines this will determine the ceiling of this team this season.
I think you and I are attacking the same thing from different angles, in the sense that I say it's never going to change because it's always come and gone. It's always like, sure, he has nights on, nights off. And I think the pockets of consistency, like you said, early in the year, he had stretches like that with the Knicks as well. I mean, the dude was an all NBA guy, Dane. It's not like he can't reach great heights. He was an all NBA player. So he has done it for stretches. It's just sustaining it and knowing if it's going to be there. Yes. 100% that he can reach great heights.
That's awesome.
And that's where with Julius Randle, you're right, that you know that ability is there, and maybe he will be on in April and May, and maybe it'll lead the Wolves to June. That's very possible. It's just, you don't know
happened last
if you're going to get that. It did happen last year. You're right. And ultimately that's the challenging thing for Chris Finch. And I think it touches on why you might have some issues with Rudy Gobert saying this publicly. Because, A, that puts more pressure on Randle and on Ants, particularly on Randle, considering what you're talking about. And then with Chris Finch, it's tough for him, because if you're benching Julius Randle and playing with, you know, just Gobert out there, or you're giving Yohan Berenguer more minutes, and you're leaning on Naz Reid more, or you're giving Jalen Clark minutes at the 3 and 4 and playing with Dosunmu and more wing-heavy lineups, if you're doing that, well, Randle could snowball in a really negative way where you're not getting him back. And you need him. And so it's just a really, really difficult, sensitive issue for Chris Finch to have to deal with this team, a team that undoubtedly has finals upside. There's a real chance that this team is playing in June and has a chance and is hoisting the trophy at the end of it. It's just, there's just a lot of difficult things to deal with. And I think it's interesting, you know, the way you bring up the mental health aspect for Julius Randle, Dane, because I think with Minnesota, you look at them on paper, they've been healthy. I mean, like, these teams in the Western Conference, yeah, the Lakers have had Luka missing time and LeBron missing time and Reeves. OKC hasn't had a J-Dub healthy. Isaiah Hartenstein has been hurt as well. Different guys. Jokic was out for Denver. The Aaron Gordon injury right now. All these teams ahead of them have dealt with some type of injury. Well, the version for Minnesota hasn't impacted his games played, but it has impacted his performance. And it's just hard to know if you're going to get that. It's very difficult to know if you're going to get that. One other thing I want to touch on with you here is, every fan base, anytime there's struggles, there's blame at the coach. How much do you think that's fair in regards to Chris Finch? And just to give that some background here with Finch, I think part of it on Wolves fans is the lack of trust in young guys, whether it was Rob Dillingham, who was traded in the Ayo Dosunmu trade, or even Leonard Miller, who also went in that, or Terrence Shannon up and down minutes. Yohan Berenguer being very, very productive in spot minutes off the bench defensively, but not getting a consistent opportunity. That seems to be one of the key sources of that frustration from Minnesota fans. But also, there's a tactical aspect that I think some people look at and they say, oh, Mike and Nori, the team plays better when he gets opportunities to be the coach. How fair do you think Wolves fans' criticism of Finch is? Do you agree with any of it, or are you firmly against it?
I think it's fair to critique Chris Finch right now, but for none of the reasons that you just talked about. When Rob Dillingham played, when Terrence Shannon Jr. played, they stunk this season. And could have they been developed a little bit more? Is there something he could have done? I mean, yes, I think he missed a little bit there, but I don't think to a fireable defense degree or fireable offense degree. Berenguer, another young player who hasn't stunk, but explain to me how we play Yohan Berenguer right now. Where do those minutes come from? You're playing Naz,
you'd have to play
Rudy,
two bigs,
and Julius.
You'd have to play a 4-big rotation. That's what it would have to be.
Well,
not
okay,
a lot of teams
then
do
you're
it.
Not,
I don't think there's any teams playing 4 bigs.
So the solution there is to play Naz at the 3. And that is my stance on that. And I think that would be a good idea. I think Naz has a skill set of that. I've asked Finch about it, and he has concerns with it defensively and Naz's ability to play off ball, be a chase defender. But you cannot, there's 96 minutes in the front court. And Rudy Gobert is playing in the 30s. Julius is playing in the high 30s, and Naz is playing about 30. There's not more minutes there. If you want to play Yohan Berenguer 12 minutes a night, Naz needs to play 12 minutes a night at the three, or you need to start playing those guys who are your second, third, and fourth best players less minutes, or maybe Naz is the fifth best player. That's not an easy thing to figure out there. Tactically, I'm more of a structured offense type of person. I think that that would maybe benefit the Wolves. I've said that for a long time, that the offense I've thought back earlier when they got Gobert was too free-flowing. And if you have Rudy Gobert on your team, you need a little bit more tactically, you need a little bit more structure in your offensive tactic. But they've had good offenses without that. Finch's offensive system has largely worked. So I don't think it's the young guys, man. I don't think it's the tactical things, at least not to a fireable degree. I think the issue is too much empowerment of Julius Randle. That's what I think it is. Rudy gets benched at the end of games. Obviously, Naz is almost always benched at the end of games. Everybody else, other than Ant and Julius are protected. And Finch has given Julius such a critical role with so much importance to it, so many things he has to do. I asked him about Julius not making the All-Star team, and he said Julius is our most important player on the team because of all the things that we ask him to do compared to everyone else. And that, I think, is fair to critique Finch on, is that he's given Julius too much to do, given Julius's inconsistency. That is the most fair critique of Chris Finch, I think, that's out there right now. Again, I wouldn't put that to a fireable degree, but I think that's the thing to focus on, is Julius being protected in the same way as Ant is, and both of them having similar issues. I think Finch has been too married to the Julius idea and does not hold that as accountable as this team needs.
It's just tough. It's like, it relates to what we talked about earlier. Because if you are giving, if you're saying, hey, Randle, you're going to be benched this fourth quarter, that's where you can lose him. And so if you empower him, you're trying to keep it consistent, and yet it's still failing, you just probably have to pull the plug on that and distribute some of that load elsewhere. I think your idea about playing with three bigs is a good one. I would at least experiment with that. Look, it's a long freaking season, Dame. 82 games. There's a lot of time to experiment. When it comes to stuff like this, I always think back to last year, OKC, when they finally had Chet Holmgren and Isaiah Hartenstein back. Dagnall was questioned by OKC media, like, well, this lineup's not working that great so far with Isaiah Hartenstein and Chet Holmgren. And Dagnall had this long, elaborate answer about the importance of trying things out and getting those guys in minutes that is not advantageous for the team, or it doesn't necessarily make sense to play two bigs, but you're doing it anyway to get them reps in situations that are difficult and hard, and that you deal with those ups and downs. And I think that's what I look at with Minnesota right now. And I'm like, yeah, wouldn't it be cool to see Naz Reid playing the three for some stretch next to Berenguer and Randle, and see how that works? Because the Randle Reid front court has just been a disaster defensively. It's been so bad. And so maybe see how it would work, at least with Berenguer out there for a week. And if it doesn't work, pull the plug on it and say at least we tried.
Can I give you an example? Three years ago, before the good season, the Reid and Gobert minutes, like the net rating was terrible. It's the worst on the team. But what would happen in those minutes, because Naz is just playing backup five, right? But it would only be like a minute here, 2 minutes here. You know, there'd kind of be bridges to get until Carl got back in. There was no commitment to it. But then Naz grew, right? And in Naz's sixth man of the year season, he started getting these extended runs with Rudy Gobert. 6, 8, 10 minutes at a time. They're both out there on the floor. And for the last two seasons, the best two-man pairing defensively has been Naz Reid and Rudy Gobert. Both of the last two times. And I think it was a product of, to your Dagnall point, of giving that life and being like, we are going to let this... We need to play Naz because he's one of our best players and we need to play him more. Let's really breathe life into it. And what's happened with the three big look is I'm tracking it every game because I want to see it. But it's the same thing where it's like a minute here, 2 minutes here, where there's three bigs out there. And to your point, I think, and maybe the time has passed, and frankly, I think the addition of Dosunmu and adding another bench piece has made them deprioritize Baron Jay, and that's going to be a next season thing. But there was time, man, I've been talking about this for 2 months. There was time earlier in the season to breathe life into the three bigs thing. And Finch would talk about, oh, we're going to try it a little bit. And that's all that's ever happened. It's like not even 100 possessions that Naz has been out there at the three. And personally, and specifically using that example from the past that I remember with Naz and Rudy playing together, like, I think it needed a chance. And this team has just been so rocky over the course of the season that Finch prioritized, you know, doing the same thing over and over again so as to not fall a couple, you know, not have that lineup cost you a game or two, which it probably would have. They probably would have lost a game or two this season if the three big thing wasn't working and Finch was playing it for 15 minutes in a game. But I do think that might be a missed opportunity in hindsight when we look back at this season.
According to Data Baller, Naz Reid, Julius Randle, Rudy Gobert have played 49 minutes together, plus 21.6 net rating in that time, whereas Johan Berenguer, Julius Randle, and Naz Reid have played 11 minutes together, minus 5.3. Irrelevant sample size there. Both of them really are irrelevant sample sizes, but it would just... It'd be nice to see when you have a guy in Randle who can handle on the perimeter and shoot on the perimeter and do things outside. And with Naz Reid, who is a tremendous shooter from the outside and has shown a bit of an ability sometimes. Like you said, chasing is tough if you're playing the three. But do the pros outweigh the cons with what that size would present to opponents? I mean, we're seeing so many teams across the NBA, Minnesota included, play with two bigs. And how that's changing team building for the NBA. Small players, it's harder to get minutes. It's just the reality of the NBA right now. It's one of the big things I'm thinking about with the draft this year because it's a very guard-heavy draft, especially in the lottery. But what does it mean for some of these guys in the NBA? Are we undervaluing the importance of bigs in the NBA right now? So I think with Minnesota, maybe three bigs could end up being a little innovative. But we're not seeing it, unfortunately. And as you said, Dane, I do think with the Dosunmu acquisition and some of these other guys, like Jalen Clark's been solid as well. I'm not expecting to see a heavy dose of that to close the year, especially with Minnesota in the position that they are right now as a sixth seed and needing to get wins, prioritizing getting wins in the short term. And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate because I would have liked to have seen that this year. And I think it's the perfect team that could have done it. It's just we're not seeing it. Ultimately, though, more than anything else, it's going to have to come down to Ant, Julius, playing with effort defensively mm-hmm. to turn it around. And we'll see over the course of time. Maybe after the All-Star break. Maybe that's what they need. Just some trips, just some time away, and then they come back and they turn it on just like they did earlier in the year.
Yeah. No, this team has been talking about needing the All-Star break for 2 weeks, and I've been saying, I'm like, yo, you guys are saying that too early. Like, for real, there's like 11, 12 games left. You know, they're in the middle of this Western Conference. So, and look what's happened. You know, now you've dropped some. Does that tie to the whole energy and effort issue? I do think the break will be good for them. I think they need some time, like, actually in the gym, practicing. Like, the offense has lost its limited structure that it does have. I do think this is a team that benefits from the All-Star break greatly. But as, again, we look at this, these standings up on the screen, you've dug yourself a hole. You're six losses behind the 16-loss San Antonio Spurs. You've probably created a gap that's too large to come back from when I believe that this team should have been in that tier with San Antonio and Denver. And really this latest stretch has kind of pushed them out of it, and now they're fighting to stay out of 7-8, and that's not a representation of how good this team can be. It isn't. It's and it's annoying that they've become one of those flip the switch type teams. Don't like those teams, you know, but that's what this team has become. And so hopefully like the switch gets on and the breakers are all set and the All-Star break, all those things happen. Only Ant is going to All-Star. Like they need it, man. They need it. I still wouldn't want to play the Timberwolves in the first round if I'm one of those teams, but they're going to be on the road.
I'm with you there, Dane. Appreciate you joining me today. Thanks again to Dane Moore for joining me. Up next, we're going to talk Celtics with Drew Carter. All right, joining me now from the Celtics broadcast, Celtics play-by-play announcer Drew Carter. Drew, how are you?
What up, KOC? Great to see you. Thanks for having me on. For those who are watching, they can see that KOC is in his Patriots gear, and I showed up in an old sandwich hat, which is a nice course outside of Boston, and I decided to pivot, did a little outfit change last minute to a New England hat. This is called pandering, KOC. I'm getting pretty good at it.
You're a Boston homer now. Our Patriots lost in the Super Bowl, but we're going to start off talking about the Celtics, who are 34-19 on the year. They've won 5 out of 6, 10 out of 14, number 2 in the NBA this year in offensive rating, number 9 in defensive rating. I thought the Celtics might be better than people anticipated this year, Drew. We did our podcast every week during the summer, me, you, and Chris Forsberg, and our guests, the off-season. And we kind of talked about what the Celtics could look like this year. We all thought there's a chance they could be better. But this good, this great, it's hard to believe to me that they've been this sensational this year. Have they exceeded your expectations, Drew?
Well, KOC, I'm glad you brought up the off season, and that's off apostrophe C-S-O-N. Because folks can go back and find the archive. Tape exists where I was a huge Celtics homer in the off season. And I did expect them to be pretty good. And it's not just because, you know, I'm a green teamer and I've got the pom-poms out. Obviously, I want the team to do well. I like the guys on the team. My job is more fun as a play-by-play guy when the team is good. So I have all these reasons to want the Celtics to be good. But I legitimately did think that they would exceed expectations this year. But I'm with you. I didn't expect them to be this good. 15 games over in early February, competing for a 2 seed in the East. Even I didn't see that coming. I thought they would be solid, you know, have a chance to compete for a top 6 seed just because of the winning DNA with guys like Derek White having an increased offensive role. We've always kind of wanted to see what that would look like here in Boston. Obviously, you know, Jaylen Brown has been the big story of the season. He's a top 5 MVP candidate. I thought with a more elevated offensive role for him, he would step up to that. But even still, it's just one of those things, KOC, where we just hadn't seen it. We haven't seen Jaylen Brown be the unquestioned alpha dog on this team. Thought it was in there, just hadn't seen it. We hadn't seen Derek White succeed as a number 2 option. Thought it was in there, hadn't seen it. Peyton Pritchard in the starting lineup for most of the year, hadn't seen that yet. And then the big thing is the front court. I mean, that was the biggest cause for concern going into the year, is you're entering with 2 bigs on minimum deals. Nemeish Kata starting as a guy who got waived by Sacramento, of all teams, a couple of years ago. Luka Garza as your backup big, a guy who didn't get much run at all in Detroit and then Minnesota for the last 3 years, and they've both been excellent. So I guess it's not all that surprising that they're good, but this good is a little bit of a surprise.
This good, and the fact is that they have a plus 4.1 net rating with Jaylen Brown on the floor. Not the biggest surprise in the world, but they have a plus 14.3 net rating when Jaylen Brown is off the floor. So the team has been good with Jaylen Brown out there, but they've been good regardless of who's been out there. And I thought their win against the Rockets last week was the most telling victory, really putting that into perspective. Kata, Garza, Ron Harper Jr., Baylor, Shireman, Derek White start that game, and they blow out the Rockets, 114-93. The Baylor Shireman defending Kevin Durant and everybody on that team playing Missoula ball. The effort doesn't drop. The style of play doesn't change. It's just remarkable to me that it seems like regardless of who Boston is throwing out there, they continue to play their style of basketball, their brand of basketball, and playing it at a very high level. I thought that game was very telling for the character of this team overall, Drew.
That one was as good as it gets. That was one where the Celtics were on the second night of a back-to-back. They had just played in Dallas the previous night. Good win, pretty hard-fought game. It's Cooper Flagg's first game against the Celtics, the team he grew up cheering for. So that took some serious effort to get that win. And then the next night in Houston, you know, the Celtics have played, you know, the Rockets twice this year on the second night of a back-to-back. The first one was in Boston. It was early in the season where we still didn't really know what to expect from this team. And they got smoked. That was the worst game they played all year. They lost by 27, most lopsided loss of the season. So you go into Houston on the second night of a back-to-back, and you're thinking, I don't really know what to expect. Then Jalen gets scratched. Hauser is out. Simons had just been traded. Vucevic wasn't there yet. So you look at the starting five, and you said it. I mean, Luka Garza makes his second start as a Celtic. Ron Harper Jr. on a two-way makes his first NBA start ever. Baylor Shireman's in the starting lineup. You're thinking this could get ugly. But having followed the team for, at that point, 50 games, I said, we really don't see them lay eggs in an entire game. You know, they'll have a rough quarter or rough half. But really, outside of that first game against Houston, they have not had a stinker for an entire 48 minutes. So I thought, you know what? There's a chance here that they surprise some people. Houston obviously has their own issues, but they're still a nightmare to play on night two of a back-to-back because they're the best rebounding team in the league and they're super physical and they tend to play hard. We didn't really see that against the Celtics in that game, but the Celtics went in there and just took their lunch money. And Ron Harper legitimately outplayed Kevin Durant in his first NBA start. This two-way guy in his first NBA start outplayed KD. The entire group of Celtics who played in that game, I think 11 guys combined, makes less money this season than Kevin Durant does. And they won that game by 20 plus on the second night of back-to-back. So that probably was the most impressive win of the season. And then a couple nights ago, they back it up. They're down by 20 against Miami at halftime. And I'm just thinking about what I just said. We don't see this team have a clunker for an entire game, really ever. And so they started to build a little momentum in the third quarter. Pritchard sort of took that game over in the third. JB comes back in the fourth, and they ended up winning against Miami after trailing by 21 at half. You just see the DNA show up all the time because legitimately, KOC, it sounds reductive to say this, but they do play hard every night. They really do, which is not always the case in the NBA. You see, I mean, you watch League Pass. Tim Legler was just talking about this the other night.
Oh, yeah.
The reason you see some crazy results in the NBA is because you don't get consistent effort from everybody every night. The Celtics are rare in that sense.
Absolutely, 100% true. Legs was spot on when he talked about that. Sometimes these teams, the lack of effort, the amount of tanking teams there are right now in the NBA as well, there's teams that want to lose going in. And Boston very well could have been one of those teams to say, you know what? We're not going to game plan this year. We're going to tank like the Pacers are and just try to get a high pick this year without Jason Tatum. And yet, like you said, they are one of those teams that never takes a night off. And there's a great moment. I thought, I'm pretty sure it was during that comeback against the Heat when they started having the comeback, but Hugo Gonzalez fighting for the ball, wrestling with the ball with Norman Powell. It was just a fun little moment of many great moments Gonzalez has had during his rookie year this year. But I love that moment during that game.
Well, it was great because you'll see it in the clip. Norman Powell looks at him and says, "What's up? What's up? Like, what are you going to do about it?" Norman Powell's a tough guy. Okay, so Norman Powell is a guy who it would be totally understandable for a guy who had just turned 20, hasn't really accomplished much in the NBA, to back down from there. But Hugo was not going to do that. And the kid didn't do anything wrong. It's not like he was trying to start a fight. It was just emblematic of how hard the Celtics played night to night. By the way, on Hugo Gonzalez, I'm not sure people around the NBA or maybe casual fans realize just how impactful he's been because his counting stats are not high. He plays about 15 minutes a game. But he is on pace to have the best plus-minus per game of a rookie in NBA history. The record currently belongs to Tim Duncan. Did he have a good rookie season or what? So Hugo Gonzalez is on pace to have an equal or even greater impact in terms of raw plus-minus. Of course, there's a lot of noise in that stat. It's not perfect. But when he comes in, he impacts winning because he plays super hard. He's a decent shooter. His energy on the offensive glass and defensively is off the charts. And he is just one of many guys, one of many cogs in this wing rotation. We just talked about Ron Harper Jr. Baylor Shireman's been in the starting lineup. Josh Minot, who just got salary dumped in a trade, was starting for the Celtics for a 10-game span at the start of the season. Then Jordan Walsh came in, and ever since then, which was in mid-November, they've had the best record in the NBA. Jordan Walsh has sort of fluctuated in the rotation. Then Hauser's been starting. He's been shooting the heck out of the ball. Ron Harper Jr. is now playing. Shireman's now in the starting lineup. It's like, where do they find these guys, KOC? It's like there's a tree at the Auerbach Center where Brad is watering it and putting his magic pixie dust on it. And then Joe comes in and says, yeah, it looks like they're ready to go. You're starting, you're guarding Kevin Durant, or you're going to start and you're going to get, you know, 15 shots tonight. It's just amazing because those are the most valuable guys in the league, those athletic wings who can play on both sides of the floor. And the Celtics just seem to manufacture them. It's amazing.
And then they just traded Chris Boucher and got John Tonjay back in the deal. And Tonjay hasn't played yet for Boston, but he's a guy I really liked in the draft. He's an upperclassman, tough, hard-nosed wing. He can hit threes, do a little bit off the dribble as well. And it's like, Tonjay's part of what I thought was a pretty good draft class for the Utah Jazz. He's not the biggest name that they got, but they trade him, Boston gets him. It's not going to surprise me if Tonjay suddenly all of a sudden has a good game for Boston when you're seeing Ron Harper Jr. have good nights. You're going to have Max Scholga probably have good nights for Boston at some point. And like you said, at one point it's Jordan Walsh. It feels like he's going to be a big part of the rotation. And then it's Baylor Shireman. The fact that Mazzulla is having a coach of the year quality year from a win standpoint, from a success standpoint, but also from a developmental standpoint, how does he juggle player development with winning games in the way that he has? Truly, I remember like 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I thought of his first year when he took over for Ime Udoka. One of the takes I got wrong the most was I thought Mazzulla should have been fired after that year. I thought Mazzulla had a poor feel for timeouts. I thought he had a poor feel for rotations. And I didn't give enough grace and time to the fact that this was a guy who got thrown in when Udoka got let go, and eventually, you know, he goes to Houston, but he got let go by Boston. And Mazzulla, I don't think he was good that year. And that summer, somebody with Boston said to me, they're like, you know, we still think he could become the best coach in the NBA. And 3 years later, since that happened, he's obviously won a championship. We're seeing him coach the hell out of this Celtics team right now without Jason Tatum, with a bunch of young guys in and out of the rotation. Yeah, he very well might be the best coach in the NBA, and he definitely should be the leading candidate for coach of the year. I'm just amazed that the balance, his ability to win games and put lineups out there and put players in positions to succeed while also developing this young talent, Drew. It blows my mind seeing what Boston's doing.
Well, first of all, the great thing about Joe is the guy who cares the least about that award is him. So I honestly, first of all, I hope he wins it just because I think he deserves it. And, you know, I see him before every game and I really like the guy. I think he's fascinating. So I want him to win for a bunch of reasons. But number one might be I want to see his reaction to winning that award, because they're going to force him to do some type of video or some
throw
type
it in
of
the trash, Drew. He might throw it in the dumpster.
it's just going to be hysterical when he gets that award. He's going to find some way to, you know, slice it up and evenly divide it to the coaching staff and the players. He will deflect. He will deflect the praise, but I really don't think it's lip service with him. I do think he is a service-based leader, and a lot of that comes from his faith. But what you just brought up is spot on with balancing player development while still winning. Like, playing Ron Harper Jr. in his first NBA start is not because the Celtics are thinking about the future. It's because they're trying to win that game, a game that we just talked about where they were a huge underdog. You brought up Max Scholga, who's this, you know, two-way rookie who is one of the last picks in the draft. He made his NBA debut in that Houston game. And before the game, I was on the court and they were in the layup line. And, you know, the Celtics were down a couple of guys. I thought there was a chance this game could get out of hand. So I just went up to Max before the game. I said, hey, just confirming, how do you say your last name? Because you'll hear Scholga a lot, like especially in his college career, you heard Scholga. He was like, it's Scholga. I'm like, okay, that's what I thought. Just making sure it's Scholga. Because I was thinking in the back of my mind, like, we might get run off the floor tonight and they might throw him in and it'll be his NBA debut. Like, we got to be ready for that. Turns out a team did get run off the floor that night. It just wasn't the Celtics. That's what they did to the Rockets. And Max Scholga ended up playing in that game for the first time. But just going back to Joe, it's not, like, we talk all the time about pushing the right buttons, like hitting the button to put Jordan Walsh in the starting lineup, hitting the button to give Baylor Shireman more run, hitting the button to put Sam Hauser in there, now playing double big with Kata next to Garza. That was a starting lineup, which we saw for the first time in that Houston game we talked about. Now trading for Vucevic, I think we're going to see even more of that, him playing alongside those two centers who have been here all season. But it's not just about pushing the right buttons. It's really about instilling belief in everybody that your time is coming. If you think about, you know, everybody listening to this, I'd like you to think about in your line of work or maybe going back to school, if you were told over and over again, your opportunity is coming, be ready. It's coming, be ready. And then 2-3 months go by and you never get the call. Are you really going to stay ready? Are you actually going to be ready when that time finally comes? I think the answer is probably no. If a lot of us look in the mirror and say, would I actually do what I need to do to stay ready, even though there's no evidence that that opportunity is coming? Somehow, Joe and his staff, and you know, Craig Lucianat is the director of player development. He's part of a coaching staff that, and you know how it is, KOC. There are a bunch of guys on these coaching staffs now. They fill up 2 rows of the bench. Every single guy on that staff has a role. Joe talks about how everybody is a head coach of their own role. That goes for the players, that goes for the coaches, trainers, sports science guys, everybody in the front office. They have managed to take all this stuff that sounds like corporate synergy BS and actually apply it, because you see it every night with how hard the team plays and how these guys you've never even heard of can be plugged into the starting lineup and lock up Kevin Durant.
It's insane. And I just appreciate the fact that they, like you said, they put guys into positions to succeed. They make them believe, but then they bring in new guys. And Vooch, his first game with Boston, he logged 8 post-ups in that game. That's the most of any Celtic this entire season in his first game. And the Celtics had, I believe, 7 post-ups in their loss against the Knicks on Sunday. And that was the second most for the team the entire year after his debut against Miami. And not all those plays were highly successful for Boston. Some of them were. But just immediately bringing in this guy, Vooch, and tweaking the offense to add a new layer to you, what you're going to do in the half court, making it happen overnight. It's little things like that that just are impressive overall. And Vooch ultimately is going to add a new ingredient here with his spacing as a three-point shooter, the post play, and the fact he's just a reliable vet as a decision maker. And so I think for the Celtics, it was a home run acquisition for them. Vooch could not be in a better situation than he is in Boston. And like you said, you can play him next to Kata, considering the fact he can space the floor. You could play him out there alone as well. Just adds a whole new layer to the Celtics team that I thought that they were missing.
Yeah, the first thing you notice about Vucevic, and I got a chance to meet him real quick before the game the other night, is he's huge. I mean, it's easy to forget this, but he's massive. He's 6'10", and when he shakes your hand, you feel like you have a raccoon paw for a hand. That's how someone else described it to me, and then I actually shook his hand. I felt that way. As the late, great Tommy Heinsohn would say, he is all of Montenegro. The guy's massive, okay? And so he will take you down to the block. He's an efficient post-up scorer, but really it's his shooting and his spacing that he provides. And the other thing, KOC, is his passing is excellent. He had 4 assists in his first game as a Celtic. You saw a couple of plays there where he would set a screen, he'd pop, obviously commands a lot of attention with his shooting, and then his vision is great. Those guys who we talked about, those wings, the stay-ready group who play super hard every night, they'll cut, and Vucevic will find them, whether it's off a pick and pop or off a post-up. You just have to respect him as a scorer, which is going to open up so many lanes where he can use that great vision. And if you think about that aspect of his game, it's only going to get better as he gets more comfortable with his teammates and vice versa. That was in his first game with the team, and it already felt like he had a pretty good feel for the guys and the cutting and the spacing. It does feel a little bit like when the Celtics added Kristaps Porzingis, and he was a huge pick-and-pop threat, but also a threat when he sets a screen and you switch, he will punish a mismatch, and that's going to lead to either him scoring if you play it one-on-one and he's against a smaller guy, or an opportunity if you bring a double where Vucevic is a really good passer, and that's going to make the team a lot better. And I really like the double big set. When he was in Chicago and they played him next to Jalen Smith, that was super effective. They had got like 58% of available rebounds, and both of those guys can shoot. If you play him with Garza, that's going to be the case. You play him with Kata, gives you extra rim protection. I just think it's going to really work out. As much as I miss Anfernee Simons, and I do miss Anfernee Simons, and we're going to see him against Chicago here in a couple of days, I do think it was the right move to kind of balance out the roster.
100% was. I thought there was a bit of overlap with Simons and Pritchard, and made sense to bring in Vooch. It was one of the needs for Boston. It was having too big flexibility, or Vooch could be out there as the solo big. And ultimately, they needed to get a center. They got a center. And in order to actually be a championship contender, they're going to have to get Jason Tatum back. And Shams Charania reported over the weekend that Tatum has started controlled 5-on-5 scrimmages. Drew, When is Tatum coming back? What's the date? Give us the exact date when Tatum's coming back.
Second Tuesday of next week. You heard it here first. Look, I don't know, KOC. They don't tell me anything. I don't think they tell anybody anything. I honestly don't even know if internally there is a target date or if JT even knows when he's going to play. To be completely honest, the reporting about him having second thoughts of coming back, I don't know where that came from. I never really bought it. As far as I know, there has not been a setback medically in terms of his rehab. I know he's been doing everything possible to come back as soon as he can. And yes, that might be this season. I've thought from the jump that he's going to play. And that's just my gut feeling based on a couple of things. Number one, he's been with the team the entire season. He's been traveling everywhere. It's not just at home games. Jason Tatum is on the bench for road games. To me, that's a sign that he wants to stay connected to the group. And I think that goes beyond just being a good teammate. I actually think that he wants to play games alongside the guys he's been sitting next to all season. The other thing is he's been very public about his recovery. You know, this has not been entirely behind closed doors. He has put stuff on his own social media. He has worked out in front of media after a shoot around in Detroit not too long ago. And he has put it out there that he's getting closer. Again, it's all relative. So he's getting closer. It might be from point A to point B, and he's got to get to point Z before he comes back. But it also might be he's got to get to point C, and there aren't that many steps left for him to clear. The team will talk about thresholds he needs to hit in his recovery, and there are a lot of those check marks. But one of them certainly is playing 5-on-5. So I don't know how close he really is. I don't know if he's going to play at all this season. But I'll just say I've all year thought that he's going to try to play this season, and nothing has changed my mind on that.
100%. I don't think anything has deterred me from feeling like he's going to play. And for Boston to be in this position without him is just mind-blowing at this point. I would expect sometime after the All-Star break, we're going to see Tatum out there. What's going to happen, Drew? I've said it all year in the podcast. Every day the Celtics put out their injury report, there's going to be a day that Tatum is listed as questionable. Out of nowhere, that's how it's going to be announced. That's my prediction, that it's just going to be doubtful or questionable, Jason Tatum and his Achilles recovery. That's what's going to happen. And then you'll get probably the Instagram posts and all that from Tatum after that. But ultimately, it's going to be cool when it happens, if it happens. Hopefully it happens that we see Tatum return. And then we're going to see him integrate into this team that has been absolutely sensational. Jaylen Brown having a great year, as you said. He's going to probably have to take a slight step back, which is a good thing. Ultimately, he's playing with such a dramatically high usage this year, and he's been tremendous with doing it, but you don't want him to have to carry that load for all year long. And Jason Tatum will absolutely help there for the Celtics. And ultimately, look, I placed a small bet early in the year, Drew, or for Boston to win the championship, because it was like plus 5,000. I'm like, plus 5,000? What, 9,000? The Dragon Ball Z reference. I don't know if you know that. You're probably not as much of a nerd as I am. What, 9,000? But great odds. And it blew my mind. It's like, well, wait a minute. Tatum probably is going to try to come back at some point if this team is competitive and he checks all those boxes. So I felt good about it now. And the odds at this point, I think they're one of the five or top six teams in odds at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. It's a team that has tied for the second best record in the Eastern Conference, potentially adding a perennial first team All-NBA player. I mean, it's like imagine at the trade deadline or a little bit after, a really good team goes out and trades for a top five player. That's basically what the Celtics would be doing if Jason Tatum comes back. I will say a couple of things. His birthday is in early March. Just something to consider. His birthday is in early March. I also thought trading Anthony Simons, and I could be totally off base with this because, as we already talked about, Vucevic might be a better fit anyway, and you saved some money, and the Celtics eventually got under the luxury tax altogether. But when the Celtics traded Simons, I sort of thought, like, maybe this means Tatum's coming back, because without his ball handling, you know, there is a bit of a void there. And you know, how do you fix that? Just add one of the five best players in the NBA who can handle the ball a lot and run pick and roll. So to me, that was sort of a signal. Again, could be totally off base because there are other reasons. But I just feel like the sense I've gotten all year is that he is going to play. So hopefully we're right about that. And if he comes back, KOC, they are a legitimate contender. I mean, we've been talking all season about how wide open the Eastern Conference is, which most of the time to me is just people trying to politely say the Eastern Conference sucks. I actually don't agree with that. I think there are a lot of good teams in the East. There's no reason why we should ignore Detroit as a contender to win the East. If you watch them play, they are maybe the most physical team in the league. Yes, their shooting has been an issue at times. They added Kevin Huerter. And I think the Pistons are a legitimate Eastern Conference championship contender. The Cavs, adding James Harden, to me, makes them much scarier in the East. Obviously, the Knicks are loaded. They just beat the Celtics at the Garden handily. There are a lot of good teams in the Eastern Conference. I don't think it's like a terrible side of the NBA. But yes, if Tatum does come back, the Celtics have proven with this roster, if you add him to it, they're good enough to contend for a conference and NBA championship.
I think that is spot on, Drew. I mean, you're right about the East. It's better than expectations, and Orlando's been worse, and Philly's been better as of late as Embiid's improved. But ultimately, like, I think New York, Detroit, Boston, Cleveland, those are the top four teams right now, and we'll see if Orlando can fix themselves or if Embiid can sustain this over the course of the year. Who knows? If the Charlotte Hornets can
keep on winning, Hornets. I was going to say, they might never lose again.
I know. They're 9-0 in their last nine games. They were a 500 team shortly before that. They could be making a leap. So don't sleep on the Hornets, especially as a first-round upset team, if they're able to get out of the play-in. So who knows there. But yes, I do agree the East is better than anticipated, with the Celtics obviously being the team at the top of that. And Drew, I got to say, I'm pretty sure I've probably said this to you in person, but I grew up listening to Mike and Tommy. They are part of the reasons why I grew up loving basketball, just their enthusiasm they brought to their broadcast, the knowledge of Tommy Heinsohn and Mike Gormanby, as incredible as he was as a play-by-play guy. You've been awesome. You've been great, man. Those were big shoes to fill, and it's been awesome to see you grow in that role, filling in for Mike Gorman, a legend, and doing it in your own way and bringing that same enthusiasm. And I think Celtics fans really like it, too.
Well, thank you, KOC. That's very kind. And I know you're just saying that because we got to chop it up so much and hang out for the off season, and that's a biased opinion from you. But I really appreciate you saying that. You know, you mentioned Mike and Tommy. I'm sure everyone still listening at this point is a Celtics fan, so we probably don't have to, you know, lay out who Mike and Tommy were. But for those who don't know, Mike Gorman, who I actually just saw a couple of days ago in Boston, we got some dinner up in the North End with him and his wife, Terry, and Mark Kestisher and PJ Carlissimo from ESPN. So that was a lot of fun. But Mike Gorman, legendary play-by-play guy, he and Tommy Heinsohn, legendary color analyst, called games together for like 40 years. So trying to take over the job was the most intimidating thing I've ever done. Even more intimidating than sitting next to you for an off-season podcast talking about the Celtics, where I was banging the drum that we were still going to be really good. And I felt a lot of pressure, and, you know, I'd walk around with Mike, and every other Celtics fan we passed would stop him and say, you know, you're the only guy I've ever listened to call Celtics games. And I was thinking, like, man, that's really cool, but also, like, holy shit. Can I say yes, we're not here?
Yeah. Hey, you stop.
Like, holy shit. Oh, my God, that's a lot of pressure trying to sit in that chair. Literally, we call the games from the Mike Gorman broadcast table. You know, so I basically my whole idea going into it was I just want to do right by Mike, do right by Celtics fans, help them still enjoy watching their favorite team, enhance that experience by teaching them something or, you know, putting a smile on their face, as corny as that sounds. And as you know, this is year two doing the full time gig. I feel like we've gotten really comfortable, Scal and me and Abby, our sideline reporter. And it's just a lot of fun and covering games from a team that plays hard every night and has given us a real storybook season just makes it even more enjoyable. So I appreciate you saying that. I hope Celtics fans agree with you.
Yeah, 100%. Every Celtics fan in my life enjoys you and Scal as well. I ask people, I'm like, what do you guys think about Drew and Scal? And all my friends like you guys. And they're people like me that grew up listening to Mike and Tommy. Like you said, storybook season so far for the Celtics. It almost was for the Patriots. Yeah. Almost before the Super Bowl loss on Sunday against the Seahawks. This was my first year getting back into football after a break, after my dad died, after Tom Brady left the team and went to the Bucks. And like, it was my first year really throwing myself back into watching football for 9 hours every single Sunday. And it was an amazing year as a straight football fan. And as a Patriots fan, this was weird, like going into the game, Drew, because in all those other Super Bowls with Tom Brady, there was like just so much pressure and so much expectation, except for the first one against the Rams. And obviously they beat the greatest show on turf. They beat the St. Louis Rams and won their first of their six Super Bowls, first of seven for Tom Brady. This one was just like the team feels so ahead of schedule. It doesn't feel like they should be here, that it's just a gift to be here. And that's the way I still feel after the game. The Seahawks were just straight up the better team. Their defense was dominant, an all-time great defense. And the Patriots just clearly aren't ready. I mean, the rookies on the left side of the offensive line got destroyed. Oof. Will Campbell didn't even talk after the game. That's how ashamed he was, and rightfully so. And Drake May, he didn't get a chance with the offensive line, but he also missed every single opportunity that he did have when he had time in the pocket. And he's still just in his second year, and there's no guarantee they'll be back. It's very hard. Other AFC teams should improve. It's not like Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson and Joe Burrow will always be on mid teams. There's no guarantee, but I'm hopeful that this is the start of a really good run for the Patriots.
Well, I'm sure your take that it was still a great season and they were happy to be there and it's okay, lost to a better team. I'm sure everyone on Boston Sports Radio is going to feel the exact same way. I'm sure it'll be a very measured reaction. Guys, it was house money. It's okay. You know, it can be the most house money appearance in a Super Bowl ever and it's still going to sting, especially when get rocked like the Patriots did last night. But I'm with you. I do think the future is very bright. It is really hard to get back there. Especially when you win the division and the schedule is going to be a lot tougher next season. But it was a pretty special year. And Drake May's the guy. Drake is the guy. He was not good in the Super Bowl. But as you said, there were circumstances that led to that. The Seahawks basically shut everybody down except the Rams. Like, if you look at their schedule, really nobody moved the ball that well against them except the Rams. I know they lost to Tampa Bay, but offensively, it was hard to do anything against them unless your name was Stafford and Puka and McVay. So it's not the end of the world that the Patriots couldn't do anything against them, but it was a very fun season. I mean, for you, I know you just were there for the halftime show, so it's okay. You probably aren't that upset about the game. But for me, I was pretty bummed about how the Patriots performed.
Understandably so. Yeah, you're right. I was just there for halftime. That's it. I actually turned off the TV.
I know you were. Okay. Sure you did. I have to say, KOC, it's been fun to see you get back in on the football takes on social media. You've been popping them off. I think you had a Josh Allen, I'm guessing AI generated Russell Westbrook mashup. I saw that. I was like, is this real? That's real KOC. Wow.
Yeah, that image got sent in one of my group chats. I was like, I gotta post this. This is too accurate. Too accurate. Well, hopefully not. They're not doing that one for Drake May someday. Hopefully that's not the case. I wonder if Drake was hurt. I wonder if that we're going to find out he's going to have shoulder surgery or something like that. How does a guy go from completing over 70% of his passes and throwing down the field all season long to them not even really trying it against the Seahawks and him missing on open throws?
Yeah.
He did look nervous before the game, though, too. You see that video of him walking into the tunnel? He's like, ooh, looking real scared. I don't know. Maybe he knew he was feeling something in his shoulder. I'm not making excuses. He was terrible in the game. The offensive line was terrible. I thought McDaniel should have put him in motion and movement more. Is what it is. The Seahawks won the game. They were the better team. Hopefully the Patriots are going to come back. Drew, thank you so much for joining me, man. Appreciate you becoming a Boston homer. Found that out last summer during the offseason.
I got a second, KOC. We can't get out of here without sharing your Super Bowl party take. Let's hear it.
Oh, yeah. Super Bowl parties are overrated. I watched the game myself. Maybe I would have seen it with a couple friends if there were more notice. But I think Super Bowl parties, you get people who aren't really there to watch the game. They are there just for halftime in the commercials. They're talking during the game. The volume's too low on the TV. The TV's not big enough. I just want to watch where I watch every Sunday. And that's at home or with the common group of people, if you do have a group that you watch with. That's just my opinion. I watched the Patriots beat the Rams in the Super Bowl when I was living in L.A., their sixth Super Bowl, and it was horrible. Half the people there don't care. Half the people aren't watching the game. There's the worst, least enjoyable Super Bowl of the six that the Patriots had and of all the ones that they were in. Do you feel the same, Drew?
Well, I just I just need to state for the record, KOC had options. I mean, you were telling me about the invites you declined to go to a Super Bowl party. I am going to say this, hopefully, and not offend the host of the Super Bowl party I attended last night. I totally agree. And I had a great time.
Was the host Mike Gorman? Mike Gorman, was he the host?
No, I would never say that. I would be like, Super Bowl parties are the greatest. I love it. I'll go to Mike's every year. But I went over to a college friend's, and they did an outstanding job hosting. The food was actually good. They made a little banh mi spread, great baguette. I brought over some Down East, had some nice ciders. Like, they had a Bloody Mary set up. They had a sheet where you could make your choices, their own little prop bets. Like, they had the anthem, and they had who's going to win MVP, what's going to be the first song from Bad Bunny. It was a great setup. Even still, I'm not sure if I'm going to a party next year, because you're right, dude. I want to watch and listen to the game. I'm still going to the bathroom during commercials, even when the game sucks. I want to see the game. I want to listen to the announcers, especially, and it's going to sound like I'm blowing smoke here, but this is actually how I feel, especially when it's Tirico and Collinsworth. Those guys are so damn good, and you know it, being in the industry. Tirico is ridiculous with how prepared he is, especially considering he's doing Olympics right now, and he's doing NBA right now. He just did Knicks Lakers like a few days ago, calls the Super Bowl, and then hosts the Olympic show from the field after. Mike Tirico is outstanding. Everybody knows that. I love Chris Collinsworth. I think they're so entertaining. So yeah, I probably, if I had to do it again, maybe I would just be sitting at home watching and listening. I do think there's something to be said for making it feel like a community event, but going somewhere, sitting like on an ottoman where you can't really get a good view of the screen, or standing up and you can't hear anything and everybody's talking the entire time, I think you might be onto something, KOC. That might be, and this is saying a lot, that might be your best take ever.
Wow. My best take ever.
Yeah.
Better than Ben Simmons shoots with the wrong hand, which is just a fact. It's not even a take, just a fact of life. That's all.
Well, it's not even a take. Certainly a better take than that garbage you and Forsberg were spewing on the offseason podcast when I had to defend the honor of the 2025-26 Celtics.
And you were right. Yeah, you had the right take. Forsberg and I could be on Old Takes Exposed. We thought they'd be a little bit better than expected, but not the way you did, Drew. Thank you so much for joining me, man. Keep up the awesome work.
Thanks, KOC. Appreciate you.
All right, thanks again to Drew Carter. Real quick here, I want to touch on the Charlotte Hornets because I got a great mailbag question from Hunter, who asked, do you think the Hornets are this year's Pacers? And with Charlotte, we talked a little bit about the Hornets on last Thursday's episode after the trade deadline, them acquiring Coby White, who's out right now with a calf injury. Charlotte actually was able to dock off one second-round draft pick they gave to Chicago in the deal because of the injury, but Hunter's question did get me thinking here, because he went on to say in the Instagram message to me how the Hornets this year got off to a really slow start, just like the Pacers did a year ago. They have an explosive offense led by a creative playmaker, Halliburton for the Pacers, LaMelo Ball for the Hornets, and they have a whole roster full of players that can attack off the dribble. And I think Hunter is right about that. Now, with Indiana last year, they were 30-23 after 53 games. And then they turned their season around right after the NBA Cup in the middle of December. Big difference from Charlotte, who is 25-28. They started 7-18 on the year. Then they had a 500-ish stretch. They were 9-10. And they've won 9 games in a row. So their push has started a little bit later than the Indiana's has. But ultimately with the Hornets, there could be something to this. There could be something to it. And that's in part because of the fact that defense is fueling this 9-0 stretch. Over this stretch, they have the number 3 defensive rating in the league. They held the Magic to 99 in the first of those 9 wins. They held the Spurs to 106. Wemby had only 19 points on 15 shots in the game. The Rockets had 99 points. Şengün had only 7 points on 11 shots in that game. And the common denominator in all of these games for Charlotte is Musa Diabate. He's been absolutely sensational for the Hornets. The Hornets have a team best plus 26.8 with him on the floor this year. And just the amount of effort and versatility that he brings to the floor. He's not the biggest guy, but he's so active in the passing lanes. He's so long at the rim to block shots. He's constantly hustling up and down the floor on in transition. And then it's just the hand-eye coordination that he has blocking shots. He had this block against the Mavericks where he just went straight up, used the rule of verticality, and then brought his arm down right on the ball. The way he defended Wemby in that game with his effort, pushing him off his spots, the strength he has, I'm just blown away by what Diabaty has become for the Charlotte Hornets as their enforcer on defense, so versatile with switching and with interior rim protection. And so I think Diabaty is a really big factor in why the Hornets have turned their season around, on top of the fact that LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller and Miles Bridges and Con Canipal are all healthy, all active, all out there together, helping spark that offense. On top of the fact that Grant Williams came back in last seven games, he's been pretty good defensively with his versatility. He's not yet scoring much offensively, but Grant Williams has been good for them as a four and a three in certain lineups. And then they have scrappy wings. Sion James as a rookie is doing what he did at Duke last year with tough on-ball point of attack defense. Josh Green, really good in that department as well. And then behind Diabaty, Ryan Kalkbrenner playing a minimized role. He's playing fewer minutes than he did earlier in the year, but he provides just pure size and rim protection as a drop defender. And so Charlotte's defense feels like it's legit. It feels legit. And that's where I look at the Hornets and I'm like, huh, we know their offense is going to be stellar when LaMelo's out there and Con Canipal and Brandon Miller. We know their offense is going to score. But the defensive improvement just, it feels real to me. Obviously, they have to sustain it. So are they this year's Pacers? They're probably not making the finals. The East is really good this year. The Celtics, the Pistons, the Cavaliers getting Harden. There's a lot of, the Knicks, there's a lot of good teams in the Eastern Conference that they would have to get through. So I wouldn't say that the Hornets are this year's Pacers, but they might be this year's Pacers in terms of the fact that at this time last year, I was saying the same thing about Indiana. I didn't think Indiana was going to be the team representing the East in the finals, and then they were. And so with Charlotte, at the least, they feel like a team that is prepared to take a big leap next year, because this feels very real offensively as long as I stay healthy. And the defensive improvement by Diabaty and all those other guys feels real as well. And so I'm buying stock in the Charlotte Hornets. They started the year as a fun team when they were struggling, one of the funnest watches in basketball. Then they became competent, and now they've been great. And so it's an awesome developmental story to see them turning into this year. And I hope they're this year's Pacers. Do you know how cool that would be to see them make a run out of the play-in? We'll see what happens. But ultimately, the Hornets, great developmental story, and I can't wait to see what they end up doing. Up next, we get to talk about the NBA draft, because the Hornets are one of the teams that they could have tanked. They decided not to tank. They're not tanking. They're pushing for the playoffs. But there are a lot of teams tanking right now for some of the top players in the draft. And over the weekend, Duke faced North Carolina. We saw Caleb Wilson against Cam Boozer. We saw some other games. AJ DiBonsa, BYU has lost four games in a row now, with AJ being up and down during those stretches. So to talk about the NBA draft, Matt Powers. All right, it's time for Draft Class. Joining me today, the editor and co-founder of Swish Theory, it's Matt Powers. Matt, how are you?
Doing great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, man. You guys do amazing work over there at Swish Theory, as always. So I'm excited to have you on to talk about the draft. I want to start off with some lottery lessons. We saw Duke and North Carolina face off over the weekend. Caleb Wilson, amazing start in that game. Cam Boozer, not his biggest game necessarily, but what stood out to you most in this game? Now, what's your number one observation from this UNC victory over Duke?
My number one takeaway is it's really hard to count out on Caleb Wilson as a scorer. You know, I definitely have some questions about his process. He's taken a lot of like difficult mid-range jumpers, but his footwork looked incredible. His touch looked incredible. You know, he was getting some tough matchups there and just kept finding his way to his spots in the mid-range while still providing, you know, some value on the defensive end. So he looked really impressive. I think he keeps kind of locking himself into that top four for this class, really.
Yeah, he's, I mean, look, the first half was amazing. Everything that he was doing, as you said, the footwork, the ability to not just have his first move, but go to his second move, his counters, he looked awesome. And this is a guy this year, he's not shooting the ball particularly well. You know, he's an average, below average free throw shooter. He hasn't had great touch away from the rim. He's not shooting threes well. But then he has these games where just everything's falling and it looks like he's a high touch player. If you're just watching these little bites from him, it's like, oh, wait a minute. What if this isn't a touch issue and it's actually just a mechanics issue with him? And what if he doesn't even need to become an elite shooter? What if he just needs to become an average shooter? How does that change what he becomes if he's an average shooter who's attacking closeouts and using his handle in the way with it that we see in transition? That's where things are really interesting and why I don't have him ahead of Cam Boozer today, but there are the supporters out there, the believers in Caleb Wilson as a higher upside player.
Yeah, I mean, I'm Team Booze for sure, even though he had not his best game. He still, put up 24 and 11 and, you know, only had, I think, 4 assists by him is about average, but a lot of hockey assists, a lot of potential assists. He just keeps the ball moving for them, keeps setting screens, you know. But, yeah, Caleb definitely got his way overall, especially in that first half. Yeah, if he's hitting those mid-range jumpers, if he's taking some threes, you know, he had a 3 this game. Then yeah, his off the dribble game looks a lot more impressive. His passing, which is already really solid, if he's getting those creases, if people have to, you know, help on him, he's playing so well out of the post right now, you know, taking on a lot of usage, especially when Vesar sits, you know. So he's looking impressive, even though I still think Boozer just contributes too many ways for me to drop him from. He's my easy number one so far this cycle.
Easy number one. Wow. It feels like a lot of people in the draft community have Boozer number one, more so than the amount of executives I talk to in the league have Boozer number one. It's an interesting difference between the online draft community and executives in the NBA.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, Boozer, he's definitely like, he's a stats darling. He's setting the record for box plus minus or like up at Zion levels, you know? So just, again, like his passing for his weight is like very rare. You know, it's like Jokic and Hartenstein as far as like passers that are that big, you know, that strong. You know, he's a great outlet passer. My unholy comp for him is he's the Larry Bird of Julius Randle's because he's like so physical but so smart and like so.
That's a really great comp.
You know,
oh my God. Sure. The Larry Bird of Julius Randle's. Oh my God. We just had a conversation earlier in the podcast with Dane Moore, a great, great guy covering the Minnesota Timberwolves about all the issues with Julius Randle. And it's kind of true. It's like a great comp. Julius Randle without the moodiness, Julius Randle relying on him night in, night out, Julius Randle making good decisions, Julius Randle locked in playing off ball defense. That kind of is the Cam Boozer experience.
What if he never held the ball and like actually took like the right threes, you know, and like got the steals without like giving, I mean, like rim protection is an issue, you know. I won't gloss over that. Like he's definitely not a 5, you know, but he's a good 4 and he gets steals. And I mean, that last shot UNC got, they kind of had to help for him, you know, so I can't say I don't have any defensive question marks for him. Much like a Larry Bird. No, but he's such a smart player. He's like, he's a quick processor. I bet on those, you know.
Now, if there's some people who are just starting to turn into college basketball games and they might have watched Caleb Wilson for the first time on Saturday, can you talk to those people and say, like, explain why Caleb Wilson, what they saw, what's holding him back from being in the number one conversation in your eyes?
Yeah, my good friend Avinash, who's a Swish Theory writer also, he has this theory around players that get offensive rebounds, assists, and stocks, right? That 3 combination means you're very practically athletic. You have a good feel for where the ball is going to go. You have the tools to grab the ball, you know, like you have that coordination and feel for the game. Caleb Wilson's one of the premier, like, OAS, what we call prospects. He gets offensive rebounds, he gets assists, he gets stocks, you know? He's just such a impactful high motor player. You know, obviously he had to play more off the ball with Cam Boozer in the AAU. Now he's taking on huge usage with UNC and seeing no ill effects, kind of keeps improving his touch around the basket seemingly. I do have questions about his overall layups when he's not dunking, you know, every time. But, you know, he keeps looking better and better. It is tough to take on his amount of usage and still be a positive on defense, you know, as a freshman. But he's doing that for UNC. He had, like, pretty crazy block on Boozer, kind of showing Boozer's limitations and his strengths, where Boozer, like, struggled to get a good layup, and he kind of just blocked it to the three-point line, you know. But, yeah, he's got good touch on his passes. I really like Caleb Wilson. Yeah, he's a good player.
Yeah, I mean, I like him a lot as well. I think with Caleb Wilson, he belongs in that top four conversation for sure. I wouldn't put him any lower than that, and I haven't determined if I'll have him in the top three yet, but I think he'll probably end up number four for me. I just can't see myself moving him ahead of Darren Peterson, Cam Boozer, or AJ DiBonsa, but we'll see what happens. There's still a long way to go. We're only on February 9th right now. There's still a lot of big games ahead, a lot of big matchups, including tonight, and moving forward this week. Right now, BYU has lost four games in a row, Matt. They've had some tough losses. They don't have a quad one win yet. A BYU doesn't. They've not only lost four games in a row, they lost five out of six. They're really sliding. And AJ DiBonsa has put up a lot of points in some of these losses for BYU, but he's averaging 4.3 boards in these four straight losses. He has one total block, one total steal in these four games. I think this is where the skeptics of DiBonsa are looking at these games like, hey, yeah, he's getting buckets, but you got to impact the game in far, far more ways than he has as of late. Do you think it's a matter of effort? Is it awareness? Why is he not at 6'9 with great athleticism, not a higher stocks player, not a more impactful rebounding player?
Yeah, I was really curious about this early in the season, and I did kind of a long, like, 20-clip thread of just, like, his defensive instincts and, like, how he plays out on that end and what his technique looks like. He, you know, you think about, you know, when you watch players, you watch prospects, you like to imagine what the ideal positioning is and where, okay, that rotation, you need to show up exactly 2 feet away from the closeout or from the shooter. He is just often over closes out or under closes out or over helps, under helps. He doesn't have that, like, perfect instinct about where to be that, you know, Boozer, for all of his faults, he has really good instincts, so, like, really quick reaction speed. Darren Peterson maybe has some faults also, but his technique as a closeout player, his technique getting steals is perfect. You know, he's very advanced skill-wise. AJ, he's just not there. I don't view him as a top 15 defensive prospect in this class, you know, despite his length and size and overall athleticism. It's tough to bet on players top three who I don't think are elite feel, you know, are elite processing for exactly where to stand in those plays or for where. I think his passing showed up really well against Houston. He had some really nice reads. But again, you don't see the elite passing that, like, I think Darren shows sometimes, that Boozer shows a lot of the time. So I am very nervous about him as a top three pick overall. I think these losses speak to that. He takes a lot of mid-range shots. You know, the players that have taken the number of mid-range shots he's taken in college have not the highest hit rate, even if he's making them, even if he also gets to the rim, even if he's, like, making threes too. It shows he has a heavy preference for those difficult shots. So I think that kind, I don't want to call him a ball stopper because he does move the ball enough to, like, avoid that label. And I'm not going to call him an outright huge defensive liability, even though I think he could shore up a lot of issues. But if we're talking top three against Cam Boozer and Darren Peterson, I have a lot of questions there.
And so you'd have him third or fourth on your board right now?
I have been kind of waffling in general about him, even maybe towards, like, 5-6.
Wow.
This is my like really out there take that I think people might not be ready for, but I love Tyler Tanner. I love Tyler Tanner to death. He's, like, my perfect player. I have a lot of, like, shades of, like, Halliburton, like John Stockton in him. He's such a smart player. Would I rather this player I know who's a genius, like, who I know is, even though he's 5'10 with 6'4 wingspan, he's dunking every game. He's getting more blocks than AJ is. He's a perfect ball mover. He's an 88% free throw shooter compared to 78% for AJ. These are questions I'm openly having my board. I think Kingston Flemings is a hell of a player. I'm not betting against him to be a really good starting point guard. AJ, I don't think he's like RJ Barrett issues as far as like his touch is really, really good. He's going to be a really good rim finisher in the NBA. His footwork is too good. So I can't like outright fade that. But if I'm building a team, I want players who are going to make those reads instantly. I want players that are going to make those rotations instantly and not, you know, deviate. Not, I think every possession where he's not scoring, he's going to be a slight negative in the NBA, you know.
I mean, with Tyler Tanner, everything you said is 100% true, but he's 5'10". Like you said, and the NBA is getting bigger. I know he is athletic, but the NBA is getting bigger. It's a different league even than it was when Isaiah Thomas finished fifth in MVP voting just, what, 7-8 years ago? At this point, it's a different league. And so I think with Tyler Tanner, he's going to be a good rotation guy. He's going to be a good player, but I would not bet against AJ DiBonsa fixing some of these very solvable flaws. To me, it reminds me so much of what Jason Tatum at Duke, his lone year at Duke. It was too much mid-range, the mentality off ball. He would lose focus. He would die on screens defending off ball. And what did he become? I mean, even passing the ball, I thought the passing was not great. What does he become? A highly versatile, he was a willing passer. He just wasn't great at making reads. He got better. DiBonsa is a willing passer. He just needed to improve at making reads. DiBonsa puts in effort sometimes. Maybe over time in the NBA, he'll put in effort all of the time. And I think these are big ifs, but I bet on AJ to figure it out because I don't think there's any questions about the love for basketball. I think with AJ DiBonsa, that's there. I think he wants to be great. He seems like a hard worker. All the personality stuff seems to check out with him based off of all the intel I've heard. I don't think there's anything contrary to that quite yet. And so with AJ, I think these flaws are real and they're definitely negatively impacting BYU right now. That's in part not the main reason why they lost. I think their bigs are really struggling right now. Some of their guys aren't hitting shots on some of those pass opportunities that AJ is creating for the team. Right. I'm not a big fan of him at Baylor. I'm still not a big fan of him at BYU either, for that matter. The team has flaws. It's not just on AJ, but the stuff we're talking about, the lack of stocks, the lack of rebounds, the up and down defensive focus, those are real things. But I think that's solvable over the course of time. So I'd be really nervous about ranking him any lower than third, personally. It's like fifth, sixth, seventh. Woo! I'm sweating bullets if I'm you putting him that low.
I get it. Yeah,
it's a good take. Like, it's a good take, though.
He's gonna score. Right. I think the most promising.
Put it this way, Matt. Put it this way. If you're the team with the third pick and AJ's on the board, you would want to trade down for significant value. That's the way you're looking at it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing in his favor is, despite no matter what the competition, he's drawing like a hell of a lot of fouls. Like, that shows he has that grifting gene. He's going to get to the line a lot with the amount of usage he's going to get in the NBA and as a scorer. But yeah, I mean, how many players where you're even like somewhat questioning what their Jason Tatum still got more stocks and like more off like rebounds and like he's a better free throw shooter, you know. There are a few players where I'm like, I don't know how this guy's feel is for the game that I feel very comfortable drafting in the top three. You know, that's just, maybe too simplistic of a way to moving it, but that's where I'm at.
Totally fair. Let's move on to our Student of the Month award. In November, Tate Frazier came on the show and he named Keyshawn Hall from Auburn the Student of the Month for November. And then Jonathan Gavoni named Alex Caravan the Student of the Month for the month of December out of UConn. Who's our January Student of the Month, Matt?
My guy is Dalen Swain. He had a pretty dominant month. He's still only, I think, 20 and a half years old, despite being a junior. His big hole in his game is he can't shoot threes, but he's a really good passer, really good defender, just good rebounder, high field player. But then all of a sudden he's come out of the last couple weeks and he's also hitting like pull-up threes all of a sudden. I think in January he's over now 30% from three, which again, his only like big weakness. He's been an incredible driver. He's shooting like 80% on drives or something like that. It's like 20 for 24 as a 6'8 player who's like a really quick mover, dunks a lot. Right now he's 70% at the rim with 19% assisted, 52% in mid-range with only 4% assisted, those are A.J. Devonta numbers. Those are pretty much like right on the number on his volume too. So I think he should be getting way more draft hype personally.
Do you have him in the lottery?
Yeah. He's again, like, I admit I draft for feel. I draft for like functional athleticism, and he rebounds again, like talking about that offense rebounds, assists, stocks, compilation together. When those things meet together, you get unexpected development. He was a 15% 3-point shooter as a freshman, 25% last year. Okay, this guy's never going to shoot. Now he's been hitting 34% over the last month. Always been an 80%+ free throw shooter. So there's been touch there to work with. But yeah, he's just a really good passer. Gets steals, gets some blocks. You know, he's not much more than I can ask for like a wing besides that shot, you know.
Well, congratulations to Dalen Swain, our student of the month for January. Matt Powers, let's last segment here. Our weekly movers, guys that are trending up on your board, Matt. Who's a weekly mover or two currently on moving up your board?
Braden Burry's on Arizona. He's been pretty awesome for the last month. Even though he's an older freshman, I think he turns 21 September, but he plays like it. He's very like in control. He's very good change of pace. He's almost like boring to talk about in the same way like Andrew Nimhard's boring to talk about, where he just doesn't really make mistakes. And like, he's just solid. He's a strong guard. He's been like a really, really good play finisher. He's in conference play, 61% from two, 39% from three, 85% from the line at a 2.5 assist to turnover ratio while getting steals. So like, he's just put up the numbers. You have to like respect that. Even if he doesn't really jump off the page, he still like dunks about once a game despite being 6'4", 6'5". So yeah, he's been really impressive to me.
I look forward to tonight's game. We're going to see Kansas against undefeated Arizona. Arizona going on the road facing the Jayhawks on tonight, on Monday, if you're listening here. And I mean, some of these conference games these teams have the remainder of the season. Like Arizona, they're 23-0. They're undefeated. And they have 8 games remaining. 6 of those games are against top 15 ranked teams. They have Kansas, Texas Tech, BYU, Houston, Kansas, Iowa State. Some 6 of their last 8 games. It's just like, if they go undefeated, I mean, it would be really impressive to get through this gauntlet.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Brandon Burris will be moving up more boards if that happens.
Totally. No.
Do you have any other weekly movers?
Yeah, Chris Tanak on Houston too. Like, he put That's in some nice one. Reps guarding BYU's AJ Devonta, despite being 6'10". He's rumored to have like a 7'4" wingspan and still is like hitting threes, deep twos, while rebounding the hell out of the ball and like shooting 80% at the rim. So he's just, I kind of faded him early in the season as like, this guy, maybe he's not like the strongest, like quickest, like moving the ball, right? He turned the ball over a lot, did not get any assists. He's completely turned that around the last couple weeks. He has a 4-1 assist to turnover ratio in conference play, which I never really expected. Making the right reads in a quick Houston system while continuing to provide defensive pressure. So yeah, he's definitely moving far up my reward.
I think him and Nate Ament at one point, they were in the, well, maybe they should go back for their sophomore years and try to be number one next year. But both of them are trending up right now, and very well, we'll probably at least see them test the waters, and we'll see what happens if they decide to stay in and be mid late lottery picks or go back to school next year. Cause they definitely could be in that conversation for top two, top three, if not number one, if they go back and have huge sophomore seasons. But I agree with you, Sinak moving up right now on boards, playing very well. And Nate Ament, who we didn't talk about, turning his season around as of late too. And so I think he belongs in that conversation as well. Matt, this was a lot of fun, man. Thank you so much for joining me. Please let people know about Swish Theory, where they can find your stuff.
Yeah. Follow all of our work. We've got a great roster of writers who kind of pop in and out and put like their long 5,000 word tomes there at theswishtheory.com. So check that out and find me at DraftPal on Twitter. But yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
Thank you, Matt. Keep up the awesome work. Thank you to Dane Moore and Drew Carter for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's show. Thank you to Father John Misty to the music. Hope you enjoyed giving us a listen. We'll be back again later this week.